Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKinn welcoming you to Nature's Talk Show, and tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. Ken Borman and I have a really great show for you tonight, especially for you beginning geologists and paleontologists out there, so you'll want to join us for that one there. But before we get underway here, Ken and I wish to invite you, please go to Nature's Talk Show website, www.naturestalkshow.com, and join in the live chat room with Ken there, and he'll field questions and comments as we talk about tonight's show here, which is geology and how it relates to paleontology and how we're able to understand what happens through geology, how our Earth has changed and what and how we're able to find what we want to find. So before that, though, Ken, hello.
How are you tonight, Ken?
Doing pretty good, doing pretty good. Before we get underway, Ken, you've got an announcement you need to make, I believe, don't you?
Yes. Nature Talk Show making a public appearance, first ever, at the Northeast Council of Aquarium Societies this coming weekend. The NEC conference, it's the 41st annual convention for them. It's at Rocky Hill, Connecticut, and the dates are April 8th to the 10th. Starts on the Friday, continues through Saturday. Both days there's going to be speakers throughout the day and evening. And then it culminates in a huge auction on the Sunday. But in the meantime, we've got some of Ken's artwork that we're raffling off to try and aid our show. So come along and grab some tickets in the raffle and talk to us. We'd love to talk to you, any of our listeners. If you've got any suggestions on shows, come along. Don't forget Tom, Ray, another one of our hosts, and myself will be there. So come along, and we'd love to speak to you. It's going to be a great weekend.
You know, I was there a couple of years ago as a guest speaker at the NEC conference, and I think I did two talks. I did one on the evolution of fishes, and then I did one on pupfish. And the people there are fantastic. They're wonderful. I was made so welcome. And Leslie Dick and the crew and stuff put on a wonderful show, and the guest speakers then were awesome people, and we had a great time. And I had not only during the talks, but I had a wonderful time just sitting around. The food at the banquet was awesome, you know, so you'll really enjoy that. And I got to meet people I'd only met on Facebook, you know, and that was another pleasant surprise, you know, getting to meet people that you only see on social media. You know, ever since I first joined the American Killifish Association, Ken, it was always fun putting a face, you know, to the voice on the phone.
It is. And some people are very different to what you imagine, aren't they?
That they are. I remember one gentleman down in Kentucky, and he was totally different for looking from what his voice sounded. And it was actually kind of interesting, you know. But anyway, the NEC show is a blast, and I know you guys are going to have fun there and going to have fun talking with everybody and stuff. So, and try to get some of that art, guys. When you some of these cool artworks I sent to Ken. All right. Cotton mouth out here tonight. Apologize. All right, Ken. Let's hear any other announcements we need to make real quick. Oh, yes, we do. Coming up here, since you'll be at that one, the Fine Art of Paleontology crew, Ken and I, are going to be together for the first time ever in all the years we've been doing the show. Coming up on, I've got my calendar here in front of me, on May 20th and the 21st, 22nd, aren't we?
Yes, that's the Canadian long weekend. Yours is the weekend after, the American one. But that'll be the Canadian long weekend. And it's the KOAC, our annual KOAC convention. Now, KOAC stands for the Canadian Association of Aquarium Clubs.
And There I will be debuting my lecture on the evolution of the killifish family. Hopefully we've got enough evidence put together. We can do a real nice lecture of where these fishes actually come from, because that's one of the things that's been one of my quests, is one of my favorite fish families, the killifish. I've been raising them for almost 45 years, Ken.
Wow.
Yeah, really.
That's a long time.
Yeah, I guess no wonder they consider me an authority on killifishes nowadays, huh? I've kept nearly half the species.
I was just thinking, next will last as long as I've kept rainbow fish.
Yeah. You know, and it's been a fascinating journey with the killifish. And another one of the fascinating journeys in my life, though, has been paleontology. And I've, from the time I was 10 years old when I found my first fossil to where I am today, it's been a fantastic experience of learning, Ken, geology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an awesome topic, and we hope all our listeners appreciate our shows. I'm sure they do.
Mm-hmm. Now, geology, or the study of rocks, geo means earth, and ology means study, so the study of the earth, is actually a really important science. Because it helps us find mineral resources, helps us, helps us find, you know, just all kinds of things like that. The geology, oil, coal, gas, aquifers, just so many building materials. I guess the list is, big, for what geology does. And, in geology, the science of geology, what we do is we learn how to understand the rocks. What do they tell us? Because what's really cool about rocks, Ken, is the modern, when we look at the modern world today, we can see these features all around us, and when we look at the rocks, we can see these features preserved in the rocks. And by understanding both modern features like this here, we're able to interpret the geologic data, and we can see where some sandstone beds like we have here in north central New Mexico, they were deposited on the edge of a giant sand sea on the edge of the Pangean continent back in the middle Permian. It was desert here then. We see, and you see limestone that covers like the Midwest, we know there was an intrusion of the sea. So this geology plays a very important role in understanding what these features mean. It's really fun.
I got a question for. It is. I got a question though for you, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you know like different geological things in the past were actually there? If it's all weathered away now, we talk about all the different uplifts and all that sort of thing, but they're weathered away. How do we know that they actually were there?
Well, that's a very good question, and this is interesting because it applies to so many different areas. One of the most interesting areas, Ken, is actually up there in Canada along the Canadian Shield, and mm-hmm. it actually... the rocks in it are metamorphosized rocks. And it's one, I forget the area. Oh my gosh, I think it's in Montreal or over in that area. But anyway, these rocks that are exposed show is like they were melted and fluid once upon a time, like they were running, not quite liquid, but almost liquid. And what that represents is that these rocks were once upon a time deep enough in the Earth's crust that they were affected by the heat and pressure. The heat coming up from the inner Earth, and it actually melted these rocks a little bit and deformed them. And these were the basis of an ancient mountain range. And how we know this today, what they were is because the mountain range itself is gone, but by understanding how rocks work, and that rock is plastic, and it melts at certain temperatures, becomes, you know, viscous at others. And by understanding that these temperatures, that these rocks become, you know, semi-plastic, we can understand how deep they were and what they represent that way, and that there were mountain ranges above this. And these rock foldings in the rock represented these tectonic pressures that actually uplift, you know, these areas. So we're able to see that in the rocks.
Excellent.
Now, another way, and this is kind of a fun one too, is, you know, one of my favorite topics to talk about, Ken, here is the a little bit of section here on Western Pangaea,
right.
You know, the Abu floodplain. But the Abu floodplain was actually part of a greater Rocky Mountain orogeny back in the from Devonian, Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, and into the middle, lower to middle Permian times. There was tectonic activity here along Western Pangaea going up along several states here from Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, parts of Texas, Wyoming, and on up along the Pangaea coastline, were affected by this these tectonic pressures. And what they were doing is there was a plate subduction happening a little bit further to the south, and it was causing mountains to rise here in this area and folding to happen. So we have these basins and these range topography, basically what it's called. It's this kind of topography is visible if you go all the way towards where Death Valley is, and there you see where the Rocky Mountains are built up, pushed kind of lengthwise along the coastline. And you got a range of mountains, and you got a basin between it. Range of mountains, and a basin between it. So that's what we had here, because this was coastline, you know, with kind of like the California coast back in the Carboniferous Permian. So what we have happening is when we see these deposits here, we have granite basal rocks that have Carboniferous and Permian rocks directly on them, and what that represents here is these granite rocks, basement rocks. They're several billion years old. They were formed, I believe, close to 2 billion years ago. And but during the, as I said, the Devonian to the Permian, this Rocky Mountain orogeny started pushing these granite uplifts here. And we have several small mountain ranges that were called the Ancestral Rocky Mountain Orogeny, or the ARM Orogeny. And these were the very first of the Rocky Mountains, basically, although Pangaea was once a much larger continent. So what we see here at the base, when we look at these granite, the base of the, I guess, the granite basement rocks, when we look at what's deposited at the contact, we see what we call an erosional surface there on the granite. That's what was basically the land surface. So it's got hills and valleys and all that was wore into it. And cut into these here hills and valleys, now we start seeing where the higher upland areas are starting to erode down into the lower areas. And we see this because we have what we call an arcosic sandstone, a very coarse sandstone, and it has a lot of the crystals are good, big, are pretty good size. Them has has a high content of feldspars, because feldspars are a soft mineral. Feldspars are found in granite. They're one of the minerals that help granite break apart real fast. But there's orthoclase and plagioclase feldspars, and feldspars break down into the clay minerals, and they form the basal clays eventually. That's what's interesting about feldspar. And but when we look at these basal sandstones that are coming off these mountains, we see that they're made up of the granite that you know, these rocks are being deposited upon. And that's what we see when we look at some of these early deposits out here. We see some of the we talked a couple weeks ago about the Atokan Sandia Formation, and parts of it's resting directly upon these basement rocks. There's a few other places here, Ken, where that's been eroded away, and on the basement rock, we have actually Permian rock, like over in the Zuni Mountains. The Permian rock is on the basement granites there. So we know that the Zuni uplands were very active all throughout the Devonian to the Permian, because for most of the period, it was an uplift. It was just being eroded off and eroded off, and that's what helped fill in the Abu Valley here. And as we get older or younger and younger rocks, you know, sediments are deposited out throughout the Abu Valley, eventually filled in, and the Pedernal, Zuni Defiance, and all these other uplifts were eventually covered over and became just part of the, you know, rocks underneath. And we are able now, what we have to do to see some of these areas, though, is drilling for oil. The core samples that they've taken all around the, you know, the world and everything like that gives us a real good idea of how these rocks are laid out underneath us. So we're able to see, you know, where the Pedernal uplift and the Zuna uplift and the Uncompahgre uplift were, because when you get to a certain age of rocks, you drill directly into the basement granites.
I guess, too, geology has a lot to do with paleontology, because a lot of the fossils we have are actually the minerals, aren't they? Like you talk about the Zuni, copper mine you go to.
The Abu copper mine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And copper is actually taken over the fossils, aren't they? The fossils are actually of copper, aren't they?
Well, here's what's happened. This is really interesting, Ken, is what we found out is that the copper minerals were coming from the Pedernal uplift. And evidently, they were eroding out of the granite basement rocks. And the water was picking up the copper. And then what was happening... And then what was happening was that as the water got into these areas where there was lots of organic matter, copper sulfate bacteria were pulling the copper out of the water, and actually, putting the copper sulfate into the plant material. In these copper mines here in the Permian period, but this copper sulfate was precipitating out onto organic material, but it was made by bacteria. All the copper deposits in the Abu set was caused by bacterial action.
Well, that's very different, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing too, when I first did geology, this is back in primary school, so it's a long, long, long time ago. I was under the mistaken impression that sedimentary rocks were the only ones that could hold fossils because of the deposition and solidifying and all that kind of thing. But that's wrong, isn't it?
For the most part, sedimentary rocks will contain 99.9% of the fossils. But every once in a while, there can be a volcanic event that will preserve some life. We see that sometimes where ash falls have preserved fossil animals. I think there's a site up in Nebraska a large number of paleo rhinoceroses were killed off by an ash fall. I believe the part of the Green River formation, the Eocene, is ash fall. And it's killed off a lot of the fishes, and that's what they were buried in, was volcanic ash that would occasionally coat the lake. So you can find that in volcanic rock. Now, an interesting thing is metamorphic rocks. And
mm-hmm.
One of the cool things is marble is actually metamorphic limestone. And you can find many, many, many times the fossil shells, marine life and preserved in the marble itself, because it doesn't get fully melted and completely destroyed, but the minerals do get changed by the heat and pressure, but it still retains the shape of the fossil, maybe a little bit deformed. That's one of the cool things about marble. Slate is metamorphic shale. And I'm trying to think, there was too many times where you find fossils in slate, but you might find occasionally the imprint of a marine animal or some organism. But for the best fossils, you definitely want, for the most part, sedimentary rocks.
Right. I'm going to have to start looking at floors, I think, when I go to places. Marble
yeah.
floors, slate floors. Go collecting there.
Yeah. Yeah,
Ken,
I remember. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how do you recognize? Can you just look at a rock and know what it is? I'm trying to say, how do you recognize all the different types of rock?
Okay, well, rocks themselves are pretty easy to distinguish when you're looking at them. You know, we have different classifications for the different type of rocks. When you look at the volcanic rocks, we have classifications for that. And actually, you and I will dig a little more deeper into volcanoes and stuff, talk a little bit more about them on our next show for our listeners out there. You'll want to join us next week as we talk about the impact of volcanoes on paleontology. But it's like when you look at the sedimentary rocks, and the finer the particle usually denotes the type of sedimentary rock you got. It's like when you look at shale. Shale is made up of really fine, like little tiny clay particles or something that was, you know, slowly filtering out of the water. So the particles are real tiny. And usually they lay down in daily or weekly or little tiny layers. So you see, when you look at shale, you'll see it split along these little flat bedding planes. And then and you can also see the little bedding planes in shale. But then when you get a little bit coarser grained, you know, you start turning into other types of it gets referred to as other types of stone. You start getting fine sandstone. We start seeing the really fine grains. Now, usually a fine sandstone is usually an older sandstone. It's where the sand has been weathered and wore and tumbled and, you know, polished. And that's why when you go down to like a beach, like along the Atlantic coast, you don't see an arcosic sandstone. You don't see all the feldspars like you would if you're up in the Rocky Mountains and you're at one of the streams there and you pick up a handful of the sand. It'll be full of granite particles, especially where it's on the granite parts of the Rocky Mountains. But if you go down to the beach, like I said, the Atlantic, what you see is mostly the quartz crystals, because quartz is a hard mineral. The feldspars and micas and all that there, those disintegrate away pretty quickly and turn into clays and eventually form the silts that form the shales.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's kind of interesting when you look at the finer grain sandstone. Then it goes into the coarser grade like arcosic. Then we, of course, have our limestones and dolomites. And limestone is mostly calcium carbonate based, where when you have dolomitic limestones, dolomite, I believe it's a manganese carbonate as opposed to a calcium carbonate, becomes more plentiful. And a lot of times dolomite is put down where there's a little bit of a higher salinity in the water. So that could be an indicator of a little bit higher salinity. Now, an interesting thing about the limestone that was mined around the central Indiana area is it had some dolomite in it. It was kind of, you know, a little bit higher than some of the surrounding limestones. So that was kind of interesting.
Wow. Actually, maybe you can help me with a rock I found on the shores of Lake Erie. There's a what I assumed was sandstone there, and it's black, very dark. And when I go up, I can actually rub it off with my fingers. It's very, very brittle. And very, very fine. Any idea what that might be, Ken?
And is it worn smooth?
It is very smooth, but I think that's just a reaction to the waves or the wind even. it's so soft, I think the wind could sculpt it quite easily.
Yeah. Wow, real soft. Lone Lake Erie.
Very soft.
Very soft.
Yeah.
I'll
have to show you. I'll have to show you.
You have to show me.
Here.
I'll have to look at it. Because it doesn't sound like, it sounds almost like it might have been a part of coke or something like that from maybe from the coal making day or the steel making days.
Well, it could be.
Could be.
I don't know.
If it's real crumbly.
We'll have to let our listeners know what it is.
Hopefully, for our listeners, you and I will be doing a show before I head back to Indiana when I'm visiting there on during the KLAC show, because we want to go and visit that Devoni site there at Rock Glen, I believe, or the Ocebo River Formation.
Yep.
And I've been looking up some of the stuff there. Now, let's talk a little bit about the geology of that there.
Okay.
This was during Middle Devonian. And this is kind of interesting because where I lived in Indiana, we had a hiatus between unconformity between the Devonian and the Silurian, but the Devonian rocks in my area was sandstone, and it was full of gastropods. I remember it being a sandstone really rich in gastropods. So what that represented was a beach sand that we were seeing there. So. Right between the end of the Silurian and during Devonian, Devonian, I believe, was the land was kind of rising from the east to the west there in Appalachia. But about where you were would have been out into the sea a little bit because I believe you've got shale and limestone from that from the Devonian, isn't it?
There is shale and limestone there, yeah.
Yeah. And
we find a lot of trilobites and slipped my mind.
The brachiopods?
Brachies, yeah. Lots of brachies. And coral.
Now the brachiopods or the spriffers, those are cool. I love Devonian brachiopods. But what we were seeing here back in the Devonian was towards the east of the continent here in North America. The land was rising a little bit, and around Nova Scotia area and Scotland was all crammed together. We were all kind of joined together with that part of Europe over in that area there. And what's interesting is back in the Devonian period, that part of the continent probably saw the rise of the tetrapods. That's where we're finding some of the evolved of the sarcopterygian fishes there, actually grading into the tetrapods.
So they were just kind of emerging?
Yeah, they would have been along the shoreline, the coastal line. And probably, along the swamps, because we do know that there were swamps. Now, what was really cool is in southern Ohio, we were seeing the sands there that were eroding from the highlands further to the east. And as we see the progression of the Devonian, now what's interesting about the Devonian, though, is that during the lower Carboniferous, the Mississippian period, the sea invaded that part of the country. And I remember back down in Indiana, being the sea was obviously real shallow, and crinoids were one of the most abundant animals. Matter of fact, the Mississippian period was sometimes called the Age of Crinoids. And and lenses this is kind of cool. We've talked about bioerms in the past, and in parts of central Indiana, there were actually crinoidal reefs where you would see lenses that were tens of feet thick. With just thousands upon millions of crinoid stems and pieces.
Wow.
No, just really, but they'd be all jumbled together, now some of the best crinoid stems I ever collected was from northern Kentucky around Fort Knox area. The streams there, some really nicely silicified crinoid stems can be collected.
And what kind of rock was around there, Ken?
Those were in a type of shale that was eroding. there's a shale and limestone layers, and the shales were producing some really beautiful, beautiful fossils to, you know, crumble apart. Now, shale in paleontology can be your friend or your enemy. sometimes in shale, the fossils can be small and very delicate, but sometimes some of the shales preserve lots of fossils. Like the Green River shales up in Wyoming, you know, this fish that are preserved in there is fantastic. Some of the, like down in another place that's really good for picking fossils up out of shales is down around Houston Woods area in southern Ohio, southeastern Ohio, or southwestern Ohio, Richmond, Indiana. The shale, Ordovician shales there are eroding, eroding, and millions and millions of Ordovician fossils can be just picked up, you know, just scattered on the, you know, on the hillsides.
Wow. Actually, I can remember doing it. I can't remember exactly where I was. I was picking up shale, and it was literally falling apart in my hands just from picking it up. Now, does that indicate an old shale or a young shale, or is that something else completely different?
I think it's showing a weathered shale.
Okay.
Where it's been out in the weather, to the
air for a long time.
Yeah. When we go down to Abbo Pass, we have this one layer of shale that we drive through. It's of the Sandia Formation, and it is so crumbly. I mean, you can't even think about looking for a fossil in it, because it's just. And it was deposited during the Atokan Age offshore of the Pedernal Uplift, just a few miles.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have the shale there, because that part. And what's really interesting, too, now a little bit higher up, the shale becomes a little bit more consolidated, but not quite so good. But in it, we sometimes we find stems and fragments of plants, including Lepidodendron. And we know these plants then were washing out into this little bit of a basin. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, being covered over with the shales and the clays that were eroding off of the different uplifts around.
That's pretty cool how you can work that out, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, you know. And because as we follow the, like the Sandia Formation deposit around, you know, we can see where part of it was deposited upon the terrestrial uplifts, like the Sandia Mountains. That was part of the original Rocky Mountain orogeny, when those granites that the Sandia Mountains are made of granite, basement granite.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sandia Formation is almost completely deposited on that, in that area. When you get here to the Manzano Mountains, the Sandia Formation rests upon Precambrian quartzites, which were beach sands along one of the ancient parts of the ancient continent. And,
so quartzite is actually a metamorphic rock?
Quartzite is a metamorphic sandstone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and now what's really kind of cool is yesterday when we were out in the field, we went down to Abbo Pass and Priest Canyon. We were seeing some of the quartzites from the Manzano Mountains that still retained some of the original layering. And the quartzite would kind of split off between these layers. So it wasn't quite fully metamorphosized into a really hard microcrystalline quartzite.
Well, I guess there must be all different levels of metamorphosis.
Yeah, some places, you know, where it's really down there.
As you just alluded. Yeah.
Yeah, where it's really getting melted, you know, you get a high... highly metamorphic rocks, but the further you're away from the heat and the pressure, you know, the less deformation occurs. You know, so and that's one thing too about geology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's that?
You know, well, being able to to understand, you know, how these rocks are made, you know, because geology, you know, it explains how quartzite is made from sandstone, and What's kind of interesting, too, is we can see the impurities, you know, when you look at different kinds of quartzite out here. We have purple quartzite, green quartzite, orange quartzite, and white quartzite. And, of course, the whiter it is, the purer the beach sand was. It was, you know, more it was the fine sands. Now, I believe, was it Tabaki somewhere, some of the finest sandstones, I think, that they use for glass, white sand, white beach sand, I believe it was Cambrian age. Really, really old, you know, and
wow.
A big old thick deposit, but it's all pure, you know, quartz sand, some of the purest in the world, you know, beach sand. And that's where we get our glass from, is from these pure beach sands.
Where is that, Ken? Somewhere on the East Coast, somewhere.
I'm trying to remember where this big deposit is that they mine for glass. I'm not going to worry about it. It'll come to me. It'll come to me eventually.
So all this exploration for all different minerals and even for beach sand to make glass, all the geologists must come across fossils in their work, mustn't they?
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, you know what's really cool is some of these geological fields that rely heavily upon the geology itself, like oil, the oil industry is a real good one. Oil relies heavily upon fossils, because fossils help indicate whether there's enough life in the seas at the time when these, because most of the oil that we get comes from marine deposits. It was from marine life that died, was buried, and the hydrocarbons were basically hydrocarbons are metamorphic organic material. Heat and pressure changed it, and so that's where we get our hydrocarbons. And a geologist needs to know where to find rocks that will trap oils, what rocks are fluid and allow fluids to go through them, shale, because the minerals are real, real compact, usually is impervious to water and oils and stuff. So it's a good rock to indicate a trap. If you look at sandstone, on the other hand, sandstone has lots of pores in it unless it's really filled in with a lot of minerals. Some of the sandstone we have, like in the Eyeball Mine, is cemented with quartz crystals, silica.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so hard to break. And usually when you break a chunk of the sandstone, it's got the bone in it, Ken, the bone just shatters with the rock.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
That's one of our big problems we have with the Eyeball Mine. It's rich, so rich in bone. I mean, bones are within, you know, hundreds of bones laying within just, you know, inches of each other, you know, in little, just, but I mean, the one layer, it's hard to explain it. It's almost a meter thick bone from top to bottom in this meter thick layer. And we only barely begin to dig back into it. And the sandstone that's around, you know, we're talking half meter to meter thick sandstone lenses just filled with bone. So there was a big kill off in this area at this one time, you know, where, because I mean, we're talking massive amounts of animals.
Ken, when that sort of thing happens, is there some chemical means to extract the bone, or not really, not yet?
Glad you asked that. Usually, some really, really beautiful fossils can be extracted from the matrix. But they usually have to be preserved a certain way. Now, we did try to extract the bone from the rock down here in the Abo Formation, the Sholi Mine, but the bone dissolved in the, we used muriatic acid. That's one of the acids that paleontologists use to dissolve limestone. But we used muriatic acid, and it just dissolved the bone fossils and left the cavities.
Right.
Yeah. I believe it was because the rock was cemented with quartzite. We thought, we were hoping it was going to be cemented with calcite, but it wasn't. So that didn't work. But you can go out here to some of these Pennsylvanian deposits here in New Mexico, and you can take pieces of the limestone and put it in muriatic acid. And because these brachiopods are silicified, silica doesn't dissolve in acid.
Mm-hmm.
And these brachiopods, when the matrix weather, you know, dissolves around them and turns into the muddy goo, if you're very careful, sometimes you can get these beautifully preserved brachiopods that show these long, delicate spines that would normally break off in the matrix. You could would never see them if you didn't do it this way. And so a lot of times, a lot of these limestones, if the fossils are highly silicified, you can dissolve some beautiful fossils out of them.
Is that how they get some of those really ornate-looking trilobites with the really long antennae and everything? Would
that
they be dissolved out?
A lot of them look like they take the time to actually work the thing with little grinders and sandblasters.
Wow.
Because I've got a couple of those trilobites myself, the highly ornate ones. And and that's what it looks like. But I'm sure they could. Well, I have seen highly silicified trilobite fossils. A book by Dr. Richard Forty actually showed a photograph where they dissolved a bunch of, I think it was Ordovician age limestone,
mm-hmm.
and the little pieces. They had these, all these little pieces of the trilobites, you know, that they worked out of the matrix like that. And they were just little spines and everything on these things, you know, delicate tubercles and stuff. And but they would get the free cheeks and the glabellas, you know, and then all the segments, you know, little pygidiums and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
So on the whole, it's just painstaking work.
Yeah, well, it is. We're talking about going to one of these sites here in the near future, down south of here. And I want to bring back a whole bunch of shale to go through. I couldn't spit the word out there for a second. And but I want to go through it with a microscope. Now, that's what's kind of fun, too, about some of these rocks, too. As how you look for fossils in them. Shales, and if they don't have any large fossils preserved, they a lot of times have small fossils. But so what's fun to do with that is I like splitting the layers of shale and looking at each layer through a dissecting microscope. And I found such cool things as shrimp, little fish jaws, fish scales, conchostracans, ostracods, you know, little things that you normally wouldn't see, even with a magnifying glass. And so that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've actually seen pictures taken from some sort of microscope of ordinary beach sand, magnified 500 times or whatever. And it's surprising how much fossils are in there, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is going to blow your mind. When we used to go collecting at Houston Wood State Park over in southwestern Ohio, this is back when I used to live in Indiana, I used to love to lay on my you had to lay on your stomach, but go through the sand that was along this stream that washed through the shale layer, and in this sand can half of it was fossils. And brachiopods and trilobites, you know, just complete ones, little tiny things. I was finding complete calamine trilobites. Maybe if you stretched them out, might have been a 3 or 4 millimeters long.
Wow.
I found a Isatellus gigas trilobite that might have been 5 millimeters, completely enrolled in these sands, and little brachiopods that were almost sand grain size. Yeah, so going through some of these sands like that is actually awesome. Now, this is one other cool thing about when you're out looking for rocks, when you're studying geology, is you look for like these stream beds that we find, because sometimes you can pick up the sand that's broken down around these deposits. We've brought in some of the stuff from like the Shirley Copper Mine, from the Triassic site, and when you're going through the microscope on that, you'll see where teeth and scales have weathered out and been accumulated in the sand, you know, from where the water has run through these deposits. And
wow.
Yeah, and you can out here, like the Triassic deposits, when you go through some of the little sands, you find little fish teeth, or you find little tiny reptilian teeth. You know, sometimes you can even find the teeth of pterosaurs. But
so when we go collecting up here, we should take the microscope along.
Take the which what?
The microscope. My microscope along with us.
Oh, my gosh.
Bring some stuff back so that we can look through it here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because, like I said, over the last few years where I've been working at the museum, you know, gaining more and more experience has been fantastic from there because, you know, it's so much. I can't wait to get there and look at that particular formation. Because I was checking out some of like fish spines and fish teeth that can be found there. So that's things to look for, you know, when you're looking through the microscopes, you can find any of these. There should be probably paleonicid scales, or at least acathodian. Matter of fact, I bet some of the spines are acathodian spines. So it'll be interesting, you know, seeing, and since I've become a vertebrate paleontologist because back when I lived back there, Ken, I was an invertebrate paleontologist. I didn't study the vertebrate mm-hmm. stuff until I joined the museum. Then I switched over to a vertebrate paleontologist. And but knowing how and what to look for in bone now, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what we can see, Buck. Also, I bet you we'll come up with some placoderm parts.
I wouldn't be surprised, actually.
Yeah, there were placoderms. Mm. So I think it'd be kind of fun to come across some skull parts. So we'll keep our eye out for that. And
mm-hmm.
Now, that's another nice, interesting thing about geology, too, is geology teaches where these exposures are. You know, back when in the early days of paleontology and geology, you know, the early geologists were coming out here to the Southwest, you know, and they were starting to map the formations and things because of, as the country expanded, they were looking for minerals, you know. I forgot where I was going there for a second. But, one of the things about as geologists explored more is they were able to map out, you know, all these different periods that were exposed. And so that way, for future paleontologists, this is wonderful, like such as myself, you know, I go through the different research papers, and it's like, say, here in New Mexico, Lenardian-age Dimetrodons are extremely rare. We only know of one Lenardian-age Dimetrodon fossil so far, and that's the one my brother found.
Mm-hmm.
And over in Texas, they're very common. Now, one of the problems we have here in New Mexico is the southern part of our Lenardian-age rocks actually records a really harsh time in the Permian. Now, this is another fun thing about geology is, you know, how do we know it was a harsh time? You know, how do we know...
Mm.
You know, that during the Lenardian age, that'd be about 275 to 290 million years ago, 290. Well, here in New Mexico, we have two members in this one formation that are mostly gypsum and anhydrite. And we're talking thick layers. We're talking hundreds of meters thick, these layers. And basically what that was is, you remember a few weeks ago, we talked about the Capitan Reef system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, here, of course, was the backside of the reef. And when the water would come, you know, the tides and stuff would bring the water in, it didn't have a really good circulation. So it just kept getting saltier and saltier and saltier here in parts of this here. And... since we, by looking at the rocks and the paleomagnetic stratigraphy, That's another interesting concept. We'll talk about that on the volcanoes too, how that
okay.
I think I got the word out right. But we're able to see, but that's where magnetic minerals, when they're put down in lavas, they become imprinted with the Earth's magnetic field, and it locks them in the rock. So if the rocks move, no matter what, those minerals are still aligned with the original paleomagnetism. They don't take on today's magnetism. The minerals are locked in. So they record which direction the magnetic flow was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we can see the polar reversals, and there's been lots of them over time. I think we're actually moving into a polar reversal now, as where the north and south poles will reverse themselves. For life on Earth, I believe these polar events, polar shifts, magnetic shifts, may actually affect some of the life, because sometimes we'll see that there's some extinctions, and other times we don't see extinctions. So it's really hard to line up where these polar reversals do anything at all.
And how long would one of these events take? Do we know, Ken?
We don't really
like
know.
10,000 years? We're not sure.
We're not sure. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we'll, you know, if we're getting ready to experience, because they notice that the magnetic field's kind of slowing down a little bit, you know, getting a little bit less powerful. And they believe that might be a sign that there might be a polar reversal. But the magnetic forces still keep the protons and stuff coming from the sun out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but yeah, that's another thing about geology. We can read that in the rocks as well. You know, so.
I guess, too, with all the modern imaging and that, satellite imaging and everything, that would, if you could utilize that would make it easier to find some of these structures that you were saying the geologists look for in the case of oil exploration or whatever, wouldn't it?
You know, the day of satellite imaging has been wonderful for us paleontologists and geologists, you know. It's helped out so much in, you know, seeing you know, more mineral deposits, you know, and how the Earth has been working. We see how the plate tectonics are functioning even. And it's really cool because this helps us also reconstruct the Earth from the past with this, this geology. That's how we know that Africa and South America were joined in Antarctica. You know, we match up the rocks. We match up the geology. And if you got the same rock on two sides of an ocean, chances are they were once upon a time one deposit, and we have that between Africa and South America and stuff. We have Antarctica. The rocks line up; they match right up. You know, just little tiny bits missing from it, and that's from erosion. So it's really fascinating about that.
I was actually reading a book today, and it was quite an old book, so data it gave might not be exact, but it said through satellite imaging, they have proven, that the continent, the land masses move. And North America is actually sliding to the west at about 2 centimeters a year.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't
Which
it?
Which is pretty, it's pretty quick, actually, when you think, when you're talking about millions of years. And at 2 centimeters, which is, for our American listeners, 3/4 of an inch every year. Wow, that's pretty quick.
Yeah, multiply that by 1,000 years, then multiply it by 100,000.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And the next thing you know, the North America is actually rocketing away from Europe at a pretty good rate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because 3/4 inch a year—that's good. Now, you think about that. I think 50 years. In my lifetime, I think that almost makes a 4 foot difference, difference in distance from Europe and North America in my lifetime, split apart almost four feet, yeah, over a meter and a quarter.
That much the time zones, huh?
Yeah, dang, it's amazing. And that's what's so fun about science. I don't understand people who deny science, because science is so wonderful, you know, and shows that we're on a planet that's hurtling through the universe, you know, in our galaxy, and we're going around orbiting our galaxy, you know. It's just fantastic stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So dynamic that science teaches us. And geology, since I was a kid, has been one of my favorite sciences. So Ken and I, for our listeners out there, we're going to be delving a little bit more into geology coming up over the next few weeks. We're going to be talking about some very interesting things here on the Fine Art of Paleontology as we talk about volcanoes on the next show, asteroid on the 18th, as we talk about, you know, the impact of an asteroid, what the effects are, and how we know about it. That's going to be fun, because I personally love astronomy as well. So astronomy, in my book, every science affects us, you know, Ken.
It does. They all kind of mesh, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they all. I see it all as one science with all these little branches, you know. It all goes to the gaining knowledge and understanding, you know, so that we can have a better future. Because I'll tell you what, looking at some of the events going on around the world, we need to stop being so petty and start working towards an amazing future for our younger generations down the road. And that's mm-hmm. my opinion. I haven't been on my soapbox in a while. We're going to have a soapbox show.
Yeah, we will.
Dumb monkeys out there, you're destroying my world. I want to smack you. All right. Well, Ken, we're at the top of the hour.
It's been another very interesting discussion with you, Ken. I hope our listeners, any half of what I get out of it, and they'll be happy, I'm sure.
Well, I hope we can make them understand the rocks a little bit more, and that'll help make the rocks more interesting instead of just a rock, you know, because I find the story in rocks fascinating. And, even back east there, Ken, when I'd go to one of the gravel pits there, and the rocks that were there in the gravel pits had a story to tell, because they, were part of the Ice Age, you know, and the glacier moraine and stuff. So even the rocks like that have a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, with that there then, Ken, I think we should ask our listeners, you know, to please check us out on iTunes, YouTube. We have a YouTube channel up now. You should go check that out. And as always, on Facebook, I'm back getting myself back in on Facebook myself here. I've been ill for a while, folks, so I'm getting better. So you'll be seeing more of me on posting on Nature's Talk Show. So
keep an eye on the Fine Art of Paleontology Facebook page. Whenever I find something interesting there, I post it up. So there's always something interesting to read there.
Yeah, and as always, Ken and I and Mary and the rest of us here at Nature's Talk Show, we invite you to go to our website, www.naturestalkshow.com. Check it out. We've got lots of great things there. So many things to check out. Just go to the site and check it all out. It's so cool. And Ken and I, of course, we're going to be popping up at some shows coming up here. Ken's going to be in Connecticut here next weekend, right, Ken?
Yes, it is. It's this coming weekend, and I leave in 2 days' time to drive there, so I hope just to talk to some of our listeners there. It'll be great to talk to you, meet you, talk to you, and let us know what you think of the show. Come on over and have a talk to us.
Yeah, and
Tom's going to be there. Ray, another one of our hosts, he's going to be there, and myself.
Yeah.
So come along and have a look.
Yeah, then come up to London, Ontario in around the 20th of May, that weekend there, 20, 21st and 22nd. And you can see Ken and me together, and also Ron Bishop, the Tank Topic crew, as well as the Fine Art of Paleontology crew here. So you can check us out there. And I'm going to be in Denver, Colorado the following weekend. You can come up to Denver to the American Killifish Association National Convention. And you can meet and greet up there as well. And I'll be happy to talk about not only killifish, but paleontology and other subjects as well. So, Ken, with that, thank you very much again for a wonderful talk.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. And I'm always very interested in whatever we talk about. So it's great.
Yeah,
you learn something new every day.
it's so cool, and it's got my brain working a lot harder too, because I got to dig up new information for you all the time, Ken. All right. So with that there, then, I want to say thanks to Ken here and goodbye, and goodbye to all our listeners out there. And join us here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Bye-bye.
Good night from me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.